We get it underway the way we do every Tuesday by welcoming in writer and critic Colin Fleming. Hello, Colin.
Yeah, what's up, Kimball?
You are a record setter. You have outpaced your previous record on the Monument, right?
Well, you know what they say. If you climb the Monument five straight times, you are a Zulu warrior. If you get up over that, you can enter Zulu king territory. But to get up to 11 straight climbs, you are the Zulu emperor, my friend.
Well, you are unquestionably that. Not only that, I've been reading your blog the other day. I guess I didn't know that you run most of that journey.
Well, not really. It's 294 steps to the top. So if I'm in a pretty good mode, I'm running the first 100 for each of the five. But the thing is to not stop moving the entire time. But yeah, I had it going on Sunday, and there was a guy in there, and he was all gung-ho. He's like, oh, I'm going to climb to the top, and I lapped his ass a few times, so that was pretty good.
All right, we want to talk Christmas, and specifically today, some alternative Christmas films that people might want to check out. And let's start with a landmark movie in many ways, Black Christmas, a Bob Clark film with, and I had forgotten what a really good cast. My gosh, Olivia Hussey, Keir Dullea, Margot Kidder.
It's almost surprising, right, when you look at the cast and it's this proto-slasher film, because you think, like, well, how did you get all those people to be in this? You have a veteran from 2001, A Space Odyssey, and everyone else you just mentioned, and Bob Clark, of course, who would later helm, I know it's a favorite of yours, Porky's, which you study deep into the night, and he's also responsible for, you'll see it many times now, probably, over the holidays, you've seen it many times in your life, A Christmas Story.
Right.
1983. And this is a little bit different than A Christmas Story because it's this slasher film that doesn't get resolved in the end. And normally with the slasher film, you have the big reveal at the conclusion of the picture. But here it's like, nah, holidays can suck. They can get you. It's basically like the message of it. And it's kind of the big reveal is the where the phone calls of this crank caller, which probably isn't even done anymore, right? In the days of cell phones, how many people have landlines now? And the calls are coming from within the house. But we never find out who the killer is. And it's a very funny script in a way where there's this whole bit with Margot Kidder where she's talking about how she goes to the zoos to watch the turtles hump for three straight days. And there's this concerned parent. His father's there over his missing daughter, and she just launches into this soliloquy about the turtles in 3 days and, like, equates it with the less efficacious giraffes or something. And it's like, okay, have a candy cane. Happy Christmas.
Check out Black Christmas. It'll change your point of view this holiday season. I was so excited to see you mention a movie that I've only seen once, and I need to see again because I had forgotten how powerful it was, John Ford's Three Godfathers.
Yes, Ford's Three Godfathers, where it's basically, it's from 1948, and it's kind of this inversion of the Magi, where you have these three, well, I won't call them wise men, because they're not necessarily that, but they're these three guys in the Old West, and John Wayne's one of them. And they decide that they're going to hold up a bank, and that's not very difficult. The part that's going to be difficult in their plan, and they know this going in, is the getaway, which basically involves going into the desert and fleeing that way. And they get out into the desert, and things start going really wrong. They don't have water pretty soon. They don't have horses. And then they come upon a wagon wreck, and in this wagon is a woman who's dying, but she's about to give birth. And so they end up, she dies, they end up with her kid on their hands. They have no water. They have no means of transportation. They have a lot of problems. And basically, they have to try to get back from whence they came with this child. And there's actually a darker version of this film from 1936. And Walter Brennan's wonderful in it. And it has two suicides among the three marauders, as it were, who turn into basically decent people. And there's like a suicide and a kind of suicide in this one. And it gets softened in the end. Now, Ford, when he was doing Sentimentality, if you've ever seen like How Green Was My Valley, it could be a little touch and go where you would ladle on the emotionalism to sort of a overly pronounced degree. He didn't really kind of know when to stop. And you have that in the last act of this particular film, in a way, with John Wayne, where you get this happier ending than it might have been. But it's a very interesting twist on the notion of the three wise men and sort of the coercion of the Christmas season and how that can impel you to be something that maybe you didn't think going in that you were.
And a nice performance, too, by a guy who's seen every year in another Christmas classic, It's a Wonderful Life, Ward Bond.
Ward Bond, right. He was in the company of John Ford actors. I was talking to a friend over the past weekend where it's like, if you were making films at this time in Hollywood, however fleetingly, you almost wanted to have this regular troupe of actors you'd rely upon. And John Ford had that, and Orson Welles had that with the Mercury Theater, of course. And that really seemed to bring out the best acting performances, I feel like. It was almost like, you know, if you're a jazz band, right, and you're playing together all the time, and the front line is always Gillespie and Parker, well, you get pretty tight. And I think the same can be true for actors. And Ward Bond, he has a limited role in this film. He's basically the sheriff. When they pull into town in the first place, they stop at the sheriff's house, and they kind of, like, lord it in front of him as if to say, like, hey, we're going to go rob your bank, try and stop us. It's like Michael Jordan in his prime saying, I'm going to post you up, do a fadeaway, just rain it over you. And they do that. And Ward Bond, he sets up a way to try to capture them where they commandeer all the various water outposts. So he has them by the proverbial Christmas balls, if you will.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown, another alternative holiday film to check out. Holiday Affair, a different type of Robert Mitchum movie, along with Janet Leigh, and a great appearance, too, by a MASH veteran, Harry Morgan.
Right, Harry Morgan, he's the judge. And you have Wendell Corey, who is at a sad end of alcoholism, but he is Jimmy Stewart's buddy in Rear Window, who's incredulous about what Ironsides is up to, but eventually comes around the 11th hour. And it's sort of a titillating title, right? Holiday Affair, because it means like affair. It doesn't mean that it's, you know, she squirts till it hurts, volume 7. It's tame for the time. But Mitchum was basically trying to rehab his image. He had had his pot bust, and this was meant to get him back on the horse of the straight and narrow so far as John Q. Public in the Middle West was concerned. And Janet Leigh's quite young in this. This is 1949, so we're a good decade plus before her turn in Psycho. And I find it just one of the most realistic and realistically enjoyable Christmas films, because there is no pomp and circumstance with this. I mean, compared to how I live, they live in luxury, but compared to how most people live, it's like, okay, I've seen apartments like that. I had an apartment like that when I was younger and I was struggling, type of thing. And Mitchum is actually unemployed thanks to Janet Leigh, who is a competitive shopper. We don't really have that anymore. What you would do is you'd be employed by some department store, and you'd go to another department store, and you'd buy their items, and you would learn everything you could about them so you could make a more effective version, and then you'd return them. And that's what she does. And Mitchum knows what she's up to, but he likes her, and he feels bad for her because he's put his foot in it with something he remarks, and it turns out that he has made a bad joke pertaining to her husband, who is actually dead from the war. And Wendell Corey gets the shaft, but he gets the shaft in like a really sort of accommodating way, where he's a good friend to these people. He's more of a friend to Janet Leigh. He's engaged to her when the picture starts, and he is not going to be engaged to her when it finishes.
All right, and last but not least, our introduction to Nick and Nora Charles, the first Thin Man movie.
This is from 1934, and it is technically a whodunit. But if you've seen the film, it's a lot like the Sherlock Holmes stories, in the Jeremy Brett Sherlock Holmes films, you don't really care who did it. In fact, I couldn't even tell you right now who did do it, and I've seen it probably 50 times. What matters really is the relationship between William Powell and Myrna Loy. And I was watching it again the other day, and it struck me as this film that encapsulates what it means to love someone and have them love you better than maybe any picture I've ever seen. There are two scenes in particular that stuck out to me. One is when the young woman in the picture, whose father, who has seemingly been murdered, is being comforted at William Powell and Myrna Loy, their Christmas party. And she's in a room alone with William Powell, and he's giving her this big hug. She's had this grievous loss. And in comes Myrna Loy, and she catches them, as it were, basically, who knows what they're up to. And she just has this look on her face, and he has a look on his face. There's never any arousal of suspicion, and they even make a quick kind of funny face at each other before he goes back to the business of comforting this other person. And it really struck me with how secure these two people were in their affection for each other that it was played that way. And then there's another scene where it's Christmas morning, and William Powell, this scene plays out for like 40 seconds. You won't see something like it right now, unfortunately, in a picture these days. I hope you will again at some point. But he has a BB gun, and he is on the couch, and he is firing the BB gun at the balloons and the Christmas tree. And she's sitting across from him in a chair. He's firing through his legs from behind his head. He's trying to get the best angle to take out maximum balloons. And the camera pans to Myrna Loy, and she just has this look on her face like, you daft, bloody idiot. But you're so weird, and I love you so much. And I've rarely seen love register on someone's face, be it in movies or in life, like I do there. It's almost like if you've seen The End of Chimes at Midnight, where Orson Welles, there are these two little beats, and he has to convey to Prince Hal that even though he's been betrayed, he approves of the betrayal in a sense, and he still loves him after the line, I know thee not, old man. And it's just a world of emotion codified in those two looks. Same with Myrna Loy. There's no dialogue in this particular exchange. It's just him doing what he's doing on Christmas morning, retaining that childlike capacity for wonder. And she is actively, because I think it's an active thing, it's not just something you fall into, it's an active pursuit. She's actively loving him, and you watch it. It's a very intimate, Christmassy, but a Christmassy scene in the sense that it walks past the holiday season and gainfully strides into the new year.
Four great options for you this holiday season from Colin Fleming. Check out all of Colin's work at his wonderful website, ColinFlemingLit.com. Colin, we thank you as always. We'll see you again next week.
Okay, sounds good.